Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, November 21st, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I'm really excited about this week's episode. It's actually a conversation that I recorded quite a bit ago. Let me see. I think it was October 16th, when I was at the QED conference in Manchester, England. I had the opportunity to sit down with Susan Blackmore. But before we jump into that recording, I just want to do a couple of brief announcements. First and foremost, I want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible and 100% free to download. If you're interested in supporting the show, one of the main ways you can do so is to visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support on a per episode basis. This week's top supporters are Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Jeffrey Perez, Ron Canoblock, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much from the bottom of my heart. It's because of you that this podcast can continue week after week. I also want to thank those of you who share news about the podcast with your friends and family on social media or in person. And I want to thank those of you who have stopped by the Talk Nerdy store. A lot of you are interested in the Charlie and the Tortoise book that I have for sale on my website, signed copies for sale. If you would like to pick one up, you can use the offer code Charlie for 10% off. And remember, it's been pretty popular. So my inventory is running low. If you want to get one, now would be the time. Lastly, last little piece of news, I have recently put up an audience survey. It's really helpful for me to get feedback from you guys so I know how to better serve you, both through the podcast and through the advertisers that I work with. Many, many of you have already filled it out, and I really thank you for that. If you'd still like to help out, because my sample size isn't quite big enough to be representative yet, I would love it if you would visit my website, carasantamaria.com. You can click through to do the survey on the main page of my website or on the podcast page under this specific episode. So those of you who have, thank you once again. And those of you who are planning to, thank you. It's really, really, really helpful. Okay, guys. I'm really excited about this week's episode. Like I mentioned, I got to sit down with Dr. Susan Blackmore. She's a psychologist, a lecturer, and a writer. She researches consciousness, memes, also anomalous experiences. She's, you know, really big in the skeptic community because many, many years ago, she was a parapsychologist. She was really interested in the paranormal and researched it fervently. She had sort of an epiphany, and then started to turn her attention towards researching why people think that they have paranormal experiences. So she's been on both sides of that topic and has a whole lot of insight to offer us. So I'm just really thrilled to be able to share this conversation with you. Let's dive right into it. Here she is, Dr. Susan Blackmore.
This is weird because I do these one-on-one and this is a whole panel situation.
I think we should be one-on-one.
I think we should.
We'll just forget this glorious audience.
Screw you guys.
And just be intimate and friendly.
Exactly. Okay.
We can grope each other under the table.
We can, and no one will know.
Oh, they're recording.
Shit. Okay, the good news about my podcast is it has an explicit rating, so you can say whatever you want.
I don't know what that means.
On iTunes, you have to put the little thing next to it that says that you curse. Like Skeptic's Guide, for example, we don't want an explicit rating, so if you notice, we never say fuck. Sometimes he'll let a shit come through.
I don't think I've ever been to a conference with so much swearing.
I think it's kind of the skeptic way. Is it a little bit? Also, I didn't see any children, so I thought we had free reign. Sometimes when there's kids, I'm a little more careful. Sometimes.
Teenagers, so.
teenagers don't count. They have dirtier mouths than we do.
Anyway, what you're saying is this thing has an explicit...
It has the rating, so you can say whatever you want.
I can say rude words.
Yes, you can say rude words. I love that. One of my favorite things about being in the UK is all of the different, like, linguistic changes. We were just discussing earlier...
Maths.
And then there was... suspenders and braces, but suspenders and garters, so they get a little weird. There's the one word I'm not supposed to say, which is like a pack in the US that you wear around your waist. There's a lot of those. Yeah.
What are you not supposed to say?
Fanny.
Oh, right, in the US, in the US, a fanny is like a bum.
Yes,
it's like a tushy. Yeah, it's a sweet little word for like a child's butt.
Yes.
But yeah, and biscuits
but we've been
and cookies.
About vaginas for goodness.
We have, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
So come on, let's all say fanny.
I know, we can all say Fanny.
One, yes. Two, three, Fanny!
Well, Sue, I am so glad that you're joining me on Talk Nerdy. I was really excited when you accepted my request to chat with me on the show, because
well,
I didn't
know who you were then.
Well, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Well, I've got you hooked, and it's, you know, I'm not going to let you go. We've got guards on the door.
Closer.
Oh, you have to be closer. Okay. Yeah, I know. I do this a lot, so I'm always like eating the mic. So my show, has anybody here heard Talk Nerdy? Is that why you're here? Probably, maybe. So my show is generally a science show, but not always. Sometimes a skeptic show, but not always. Sometimes I interview interesting women in the feminist movement. Sometimes I interview just people who have interesting lives. And it's a one-on-one chat. It's a conversation. I think that most of my listeners probably already know who you are. But for those that don't, I would love, and I apologize, there may be some repeats from Sue's talk that I'm sure you all went to, but I would love to dig into the fascinating story of how you became such a prominent skeptic from such an unskeptical place.
Mm.
So would you still call, because you know when you look you up on Wikipedia, one of the first things it says is that you are a parapsychologist.
Yes, and I don't object to that, because
okay.
I was a parapsychologist. Mm-hmm. And I also like to defend parapsychology, because there are some people who say parapsychology is pseudoscience and it should be abolished. No, parapsychology, at its best at any rate, is a genuine scientific attempt mm-hmm. to ask questions like, is there such a thing as telepathy? Can people communicate in some other way? Can people see things at a distance? Do dreams ever come true? Given the number of people who have what they think are precognitive dreams, and the number of people who just think of the person when they phone or mm-hmm. around the corner, that's a legitimate thing to investigate, and parapsychology is a science of investigating it. So we need that science to carry on. The sad fact is, if you're a parapsychologist, you get endless negative results, and it gets really tedious after a while. But, you know, it is properly done. You know, the statistical methods are pretty... They have been way ahead of ordinary psychology, because they have to be. Sometimes they go wrong, sometimes people cheat, but the methodology has developed hugely, so it's a science. So I don't mind that people say that I used to be a parapsychologist. I'm
sure.
Not one now, but that's fine.
It's interesting that you say, you know, the methodology has to be really stringent, and sometimes they were kind of ahead of the curve of regular psychology, because I sort of defend psychology in the same way amongst my peers, because I kind of went psychology and then biology, and a lot of people think, well, psychology is not a real science, or it's a soft science.
Yeah.
And the methodology that you use to investigate when you're looking at human behavior, you have to be so much more careful than when you can just clone 30 of the exact same mouse and then do one thing to all of them and see what the difference is.
Yeah.
Humans have all of these different confounding variables, and you have to get very creative in your approach, and you have to really know your maths.
Very well spoken.
Do you find, or did you find, when you were actively working in parapsychology, that there was a motivation to cheat? Did you find that there were peers that would publish results that you were like, oh, I don't know about that. I need to try and replicate that.
Those are two separate and interesting questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, huge motivation to cheat. And a lot of the best people trying to acknowledge that motivation, try even harder to make sure that it didn't happen or that there weren't loopholes, and also expectation effects and so on, not actual cheating, but really trying to deal with that.
Sure.
Sadly, I came across one case, and it was heartbreaking is probably not too strong a word for it to me. A a man who was a friend of mine, not a close friend, but had become a friend, a colleague. He was working at Cambridge doing research on the Ganzfeld effect, where the receiver in a telepathy experiment has ping pong balls over their eyes, white noise, pink light, you know, and they get very relaxed and have all this imagery, and then somebody at a distance is looking at a video or a picture or whatever, and they have to try and pick it up. And I'd been doing this and getting absolute chance results, and he'd been doing it and getting fantastic results.
Oh, wow.
And the Society for Psychical Research, which I was much involved with in those days, paid me a very small grant, just my train fare and, you know, whatever, so that I could go to Cambridge and spend some time learning these psi conducive techniques.
I see. Oh, you just didn't have the right techniques.
I didn't have that.
Sure.
Actually, later on, I was definitely a psi inhibitory experimenter. So wherever I went, the psychic phenomena disappeared. But this time I wasn't already so bad as that, and it was thought by people in general that I could probably learn psi-conducive techniques. So I went to watch how he did it, and the first day that I was there, he did three trials, and they were really successful. Two of them were very successful, and I was very quickly in the position of knowing that either, given the design, which I could see clearly, and the stats he was going to use and everything else, either that this was actually evidence of a psychic effect, or it was cheating. Mm-hmm. I could not see a way in which I couldn't see any mistakes in the methodology. It was very tightly done.
It couldn't be a false positive. It couldn't be anything.
Well,
it had
from that few trials, of course, it could be just luck. Mm-hmm. But given the setup was really good. So I realised then in myself that I was already becoming sceptical then. And I realised in myself the fear kind of thing. And excitement. Get torn. I mean, just imagine, probably you're all so sceptical you wouldn't feel this, but yeah. You'd only feel it in one direction. I felt it in both directions. Wow, if it's really true, I'll have to throw over my scepticism and go back to my belief that I had before. And, you know, and if it's cheating, oh no, that's awful, that's terrible. But on the other hand, I could keep my scepticism. And, you know, a really emotional thing. And then to discover, as far as I'm concerned, I found that he was cheating. It was awful, really awful. And it has had a huge impact, because there aren't that many Ganzfeld experiments, and his data go in all the meta-analyses. And I've tried to write to the journals where it is and say, look, you know, count these as flawed in your flaw analysis and your meta-analysis, you know, it stays there in the literature, and people are...
They were never retracted?
No.
Oh, wow. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, it was 8 years later that I didn't want to accuse him of fraud without giving him a chance to write back. It took 8 years before he wrote back, and that was all published, but the meta-analyses going in prestigious journals still included his results. The will to believe that there are positive results in parapsychology is huge, and it's depressing because it has a real-world effect. If people think there are some serious scientists out there and look at these, you know, peer-reviewed papers that say it's true, and it's based on that.
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot, I think, in the skeptical movement about the difference and which is kind of more pernicious, the psychic or the mystic who really believes, or the homeopath who really believes what they're selling, or the one who, like, is just an outright charlatan. I think that's actually much more rare.
So
yeah, but when it does happen, it's such a slap in the face, isn't it?
It's awful. My impression, because after my years in parapsychology, I got to do loads of media stuff and go on all the TV shows, and, you know, 100 people who've seen a ghost and see a black mother say it's, you know, whatever. It's always one. The BBC Balance, you know, you've got to have one.
Yeah.
Have the nasty sort, the unspiritual, close-minded, reductionist,
right?
Materialist, you know, all that.
Yeah, you're always the villain.
Yeah, always the villain.
Such
always
a bummer.
The villain. That's another whole story. I could talk for an hour about being made the villain, absolutely. But one thing that stuck out in my mind was a TV program I did with Doris Stokes. I mean, I met lots of mediums. I trained, you know, began in my believing days. I began training in a lot of these things, in being a witch and a medium and stuff. But I went to a TV program with very famous medium, Doris Stokes. She was a lovely granny, friendly, you know, cuddly type. And my impression from most of the ones I'd met is that they genuinely believed. Mm. They weren't at all critical. They just, you know, thought they were doing good. I sat next to in the TV studio a couple, a middle-aged couple, and we were chatting while the whole thing, waiting for it to happen. And they had three daughters, and one had fallen out of a second floor, you'd call it third floor, I think, window, and landed on railings,
and
pierced by the railings and died.
Yeah.
And they lived somewhere up here near Manchester, I think, and they travelled down to London every week to go and see Doris Stokes and communicate with their daughter. And all I kept thinking was, what about the other two? They have lost their sister. Yeah. And their parents are buggering off down to London every week. And I just felt that this was doing awful, awful harm to these, to the family. Mm-hmm. And it turned out later when Doris Stokes died that it was a serious fraud. She had, you know, she was had people out collecting information from, and you know, all the usual tricks so that she could appear to be, you know, true.
She wasn't a sweet granny.
No,
no. It's horrible.
It is horrible. It is horrible. But a lot of them were sweet grannies.
A lot of them are.
And I would say the vast majority, they really believe they're doing good. The harm they're doing when they are doing harm, which is not always, but very often, is inadvertent. They don't realize it. Some of them do realize it, and then it's a terrible cognitive dissonance, like I had. And, you know, I can say, as a scientist, going through the cognitive dissonance of having believed so much weird stuff for quite a long time and having to change your mind is quite painful. But I'm so glad I did it because I'm no longer frightened of doing it. But I can understand why people find it really hard because it is kind of hard.
I can only imagine, you know, when I my only real experience like that would be leaving the church.
Yeah.
But I was 14, and when you're 14, you like hate authority. And so there is, I think, not that it was much easier for me because there are other reasons why it's more difficult when you're a child. But there is kind of that spirit, or I had that spirit in me at the time. And so although there was a conflict, like I didn't want to let my parents down, I think ultimately in being true with myself, I wasn't leaving anything behind that I was really that dedicated or committed to. Yep. I just didn't want to disappoint the people that I love. I'm fascinated and interested because you mentioned just a few minutes ago, you know, you guys are all skeptics, so I'm not sure if any of you have had that experience of having to come to the light and leave this other world. This idea of being credulous. Obviously we've all had things that we've been credulous about and had to fight against, but like I've never believed in ghosts, for example, or believed in like psychic phenomena. It just never was on my radar, I don't think. And I left the church when I was so young. I was just always kind of in that world. I'm trying to imagine experiencing this utter shift in my paradigm, in my worldview as an adult. And how did you handle, I mean, that's the part. How did you handle that shift? And did it rock you psychologically?
Oh, yes.
You know?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. First, I suppose there was the shift in the first direction. Mm-hmm. So I had this mega dramatic out of the body experience when I was 19 in 1970. And I think my views before then, hey, I was 19. I'd done science A levels at school. I was doing physiology and psychology at university. And I was sort of loosely scientific. I'd read a couple of books on psychic things and it was kind of intriguing. So I wasn't really committed one way or the other. But when I had this experience and it was so completely vivid and realistic, and there I was on the ceiling looking down and it was completely clear and vivid, you know, of course it made me believe these things. And that was a big change. That was, wow, now I know.
Yeah.
I understand people, all these near-death people going, I know heaven is for real. Because of that, the way it feels. So there was that shift first. And that was kind of hard, but then it was fun. Because I took on all the, you know, it was a hippie era, you know, we're talking 1970. And so I was wearing my hippie clothes and I had my crystal ball and I read everyone's tarot cards and, you know, all that stuff.
And it brings you meaning, right? Like you find meaning in something like that. So it's a positive experience.
Oh, it was hugely positive. And it became fun, and I got on the, you know, involved in the Society for Psychical Research and all these other, and that was all fun. So that was a kind of a shift. Mm-hmm. But then I got dug in more and more, and my whole persona became, oh, she's the psychic one. Oh, she's that, you know, that's who I was. So we're not just talking about changing your head, it was changing your
identity.
Yes.
And like, not just your thing. Personal worldview, the way the world sees you, which sometimes is more difficult to break, right?
Yes.
Because we define ourselves with that kind of mirror.
Yes. I wouldn't have said it in that way at the time, but I did feel the strength of having to sort of realize that people were assuming things about me that really weren't true. Probably like a lot of atheists in America. I mean, it's different here because there are now more nuns than no religions than there are Christians in Britain. But in America, I know it's kind of hard that people see you. You know, you're hiding and you're pretending and all of that.
It takes a while until you find, especially like, you know, me. I grew up in Texas, so when I came out as atheist, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah,
like, you know, like I didn't know there were anybody.
Out as an atheist. It's like, well, the first time I went to an American atheist conference, I was like, you have to come out as an atheist. Like, I just make the assumption everyone's an atheist unless they tell me they believe in God. But that's another thing.
I do that now that I live in LA, and and then I forget. Go to other parts of the country, and I'm like, oh shit.
We had the American atheist in Memphis last year, which is brilliant. Or was it this year? I don't know.
I did one in Austin, which is a little bit.
Anyway, back to your question. So to come to the more important change. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I don't know how to remember it. This is a long time ago. But as far as I can remember it, gradually, I do experiments on telepathy, and they didn't work. They came chance results. And then I do some clairvoyance ones and then some precognition ones, and they didn't work. And then there'll always be, if you go around another corner, there'll be, you know, if this doesn't work, this will work.
Yeah, it's and just I got to change the parameters and try something new.
Yes, but it got to the point when lab experiments are not going to work, hence the out-of-body experiments I did with targets in my kitchen, and people who had their out-of-body experience or astral projection, if they believed in that, could come and visit it, and all of these things. And I kept on and on and on. But there was a kind of a point, and I remember this. It's one of those flashbulb memories.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in my little house in Guildford, and where I was doing my PhD at Surrey University. And I was in the bath one day, and I was towards the end of my PhD, and I'd gotten no results, and I'd slept in haunted houses, and no ghosts came. And, you know, by then I was called a psi inhibitory experimenter, and I was really bad. And, but I still believed in there's something around the next corner. And I was lying there in that bath, and for the first time, this sounds weird, but for the first time ever, I thought, what if it's all bunk?
Yeah.
And that was so different from thinking, well, oh, I've discovered that this doesn't work, but there might be. It was a real turnaround, and that was a point when I had to kind of get up out of the bath as a different person and put on whatever clothes I put on and go, you know, okay, what if this? And it wasn't that I was sure. It was that this is a new hypothesis. What if there's nothing in it? And that was then a different way of approaching it, and I've never looked back. I still could. I mean, there could be things that would make me change back. And that's why I said earlier, I'm not afraid of having... I'm kind of afraid. I'm afraid, when I'm in my kayak and it's a bit rough and I think, have I misjudged this situation? but I'll do it. So it's that sort of fear. You know you've done it and you'll know you'll cope if it happened again.
I think what makes you, amongst many other things, a good skeptic is that you can say that, if there's new evidence...
Yeah, that's right.
You're going to follow it, and that's important. But that shift, that moment, it's funny because I think anybody in the audience, anybody listening, can think about a time, and it may not be with skepticism, and it may not be with religion or anything like that, where admitting something to yourself made it real. You know, where there was something happening and it's such a human experience, that phenomenon, right? I remember having a friend who had made some mistakes in college, and she was caught a few bugs that she needed to take care of at the clinic, and had an experience where I remember talking to her and saying, like, have you had your HIV test? And she's like, I don't want to know. It was just this weird, like, I don't want to take it because then it could be real. Luckily, she came out, you know, clean on that end, and everything she was able to take care of could be solved with medication. But there is that experience, you know, or somebody loses a loved one, and until they say it, it's not real. Or you're going through a divorce, and until you call them your ex or you take off the ring, there's these moments that make things real. Yeah. It's denial is so strong. And it makes me wonder if that clarity that you had in the bath, if it had been building and you hadn't let yourself see it, or if it really was a huge kind of
both. I think it was both. I think it had been building, but it had it was as though there's this much stuff potentially, and this much has gone, you know, the little tiny thing was just getting smaller and smaller, like a pop.
Yeah,
the final last bit's gone, and suddenly the view looks different. I don't know, how can I tell, it's such a long time ago, but I don't think I was denying it so much as genuinely thinking there's got to be something because of my own experience. And that's why then when I stopped doing straight parapsychology, looking for paranormal phenomena, I wanted to know, well, why do these experiences happen? And that, of course, is what I've been writing a new book about it now, because the science now of out-of-body experiences is fantastic. We're really beginning to get to understand what's going on. So the joy that came out of all that failure was partly, you know, what we've talked about already, but was realizing that lots of people's beliefs depend on them having genuine experiences. And the best way I can help people to let go of false beliefs is by explaining things like lucid dreams, sleep paralysis, various kinds of visual illusions, auditory illusions, and out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences and tunnels. All these things we have explanations for pretty, and they're getting better and there's more questions to ask. I hope that helps people. I mean, a lot of people ask me, you know, yeah, but I've had this, you know, what happened? And I'll say, aha. And I hope it helps.
I think probably the vast majority of people do really positively respond in a medical situation or a psychiatric situation to having a label, to having an explanation, to having somebody listen to them and say, oh, you're not crazy. This is a totally normal experience that people have because of this phenomenon. It's incredibly meaningful for a lot of people. There's still, I think, a small percentage of the population who just doesn't want to know or who just kind of likes the myth better. You know, I know many people who couldn't tell me the meds they take. They just, oh, I take the pills that are on the thing and I don't know what any of them do. You know, it's just crazy to me. But it is a way that some people function in the world. It's kind of like, if I'm in this murky cloud, I can prevent myself from experiencing the things that cause true pain, or I can, you know. But I think there is such a central human drive to know ourselves, you know. And I can only imagine if I had ever had, and it could be that part of the reason that I was just kind of a born skeptic, and even when I was religious, I never really fell into it, that I've never had any of those experiences. I couldn't point to any like crazy coincidences in my life, or, you know, what do you call it? Like the sleep paralysis, and then I thought maybe there was an alien visiting. Like, none of that's ever happened to me. And it's very hard. You know, empathy is a skill that we work on. It's not natural for anyway, and we have to work on being empathic and listening to people's experiences and not just writing it off as like, oh, yeah, I mean, there's a good explanation for that, or like, oh, you're just crazy. It's like, no, let's talk about it and see why your special situation was very special to you.
I was talking to someone this morning at breakfast. Who, first, I couldn't find any experience that he'd had.
Mm-hmm.
He was a skeptic.
Right.
and I couldn't find any experience. He's kind of like, I don't understand what you mean about this out-of-body experience. You know. And then it turned out he had lucid dream. And so I had something to sort of make a comparison. It's different from that, but it has things in common. Can usually find something. But it's amazing. I think sleep paralysis is probably the one where it's, if you don't know what it is, it's really frightening. You were saying about giving labels. If you don't know what it is, it's terrifying. If anyone listening doesn't know what it is, it's when you wake up, usually wake up, it can be as you're falling asleep, you wake up and you think you're wide awake, but you can't move. And the more you struggle, the worse it gets, and you feel a heavy weight on your chest. You very often hear grinding, crunching kind of noise, mechanical sort of noises. There's people nodding. and you sometimes have sort of sexual feelings and feelings of things on the skin, and you know, it can be really horrible. And if you've never heard of it, how awful is that? So, you know, understandably, people think aliens are coming to get them or whatever like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've often felt that the work that I do has been very self-indulgent. Just, I'm curious, I want to understand. But I remember the first time I felt, oh, I've done some good, and it was amazing, was I was on a radio program a long time ago, and talking about sleep paralysis. And I got letters, this is before email, and I got one letter. I should say that my feelings about marriage are, on the whole, you know, it's slavery for women and John Stuart Mill
and
that
sort of
stuff.
I'm so with you. I have a wonderful live-in boyfriend, and I will probably never get married because there's something very uncomfortable about that to me.
I am married, but it took 17 years. My husband asked me again and again and again for 17 years before I finally gave in. So I'm a hypocrite as well. But I'm only saying this because of this letter that I got. And this woman wrote to me, and she said, I heard you on Women's Hour yesterday, and I just have to write and tell you, I've had sleep paralysis all my life. I've never told anybody. I didn't have a name for it. I didn't know that anybody else ever had it. I thought I was going mad. And my boyfriend has asked me to marry him lots of times, and I've always said no because I thought it might be inherited, and I thought I might be mad.
Gosh.
But since I heard your program, listen to them all going,
oh, no.
Since I heard your program, we've got engaged and we're going to be married.
It's amazing. I know, you cried on air, didn't you?
Well, I did have a little moment of...
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Now, of course, now, with the internet, of course there are still people who've never heard of sleep paralysis, but all you have to do is hear that phrase. You can look it up. You can be reassured. But there were an awful lot of people then who had out-of-body experiences, tunnel experiences, floating, drifting. There were all kinds of simple things and were terrified.
Now
they can be reassured.
You can, and you can find it, which is wonderful, and you can find important conversations about it by people like yourself, so they can really learn about the research that's going on and understand the symptomatology, but you still kind of have to admit to yourself that it's happening and feel confident enough to start to dig into it. I had probably my closest weird experiences that I had a visual migraine for the first time at like 30 years old, and I've never had a migraine headache. There's never been pain, and out of the blue, I was watching television, and I had a scintillating scotoma, like this zigzag across my vision that was dancing and glittering, and I was like, what the fuck is that? Am I having a stroke? I don't know. It was really scary. It was so bright that I couldn't focus. It took about 20 minutes until it passed. Luckily, I had read Migraine by Oliver Sacks, and I knew it was called a scintillating stochoma. Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, I'm just going to make sure that's what it is. But you go to the Wikipedia page, you go to these different Google sites, and people who have experienced it themselves, who have graphic, motion graphic experience, have made these amazing videos of what it looks like. And then you're like, oh, that's totally what I have.
Yeah.
And then you find out that it's usually benign and it's nothing to be too afraid of. But I'll go get a brain scan. If it looks good, I'm probably safe, blah, blah, blah. And that's a huge comfort.
Yeah.
I can only imagine what it would have been like 50 years ago, 100 years ago, you have an experience like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is an angel, a demon? I mean, what other way do you have to describe these things?
And this is true in many countries still in the world, where, and particularly women, are deprived of education and of access to the internet and so on, and still frightened and even more frightened. But one thing that does bother me, I must say, is when I am able, with the things that mostly I have expertise on, particularly out-of-body experiences, sleep paralysis and so on, and someone tells me an experience and I'm able to say, and I can ask the questions, well, did you have a tunnel? Did you see the light? What color was the light? Questions will help me understand what's going on. And a lot of people are, wow, that's really interesting. But a lot are like, yeah, but it wasn't like that. It was my spirit leaving the body.
Yeah.
And you're seeing there the clash, a horrible clash, and I don't know how to deal with that. I've never really discovered a way, because I just get exasperated and have to bite my lip, and I'm wanting to say, but don't you find it interesting that this is happening in your brain, and everything that happens to you is because of your brain and your body and the world around, doesn't that excite you to learn about it? Oh, but you don't understand, I've been to heaven. But there'll be people listening who know they've been to heaven.
Sure.
And I'm going, well, why is your... I can't tell you. When I've been writing this OBE book, I really didn't want to get into near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my editor at the publisher, can I just leave out near-death experiences? And he said, no.
He's like, that's how we're going to sell the damn book.
Yeah. No, but for a good reason. Mm-hmm. Because he said, this is all part of Little Brown. And he said, one of the different parts of the publisher publishes some of these ghastly books.
Oh, wow.
And he said, we really want in our bit, we really want a book that's going to explain all that stuff. You've got to have that bit in there or you won't be doing the job. And of course, I'm with that. I said, I'll write one chapter. Well, it turned into three. And I had... And I had to read these ghastly... I have written a book on near-death experiences before. I have theories about it to do with cortical hyperactivity and so on. But I had to read some of these books. Proof of Heaven, Heaven is for Real, My Journey to Heaven, I Went to Heaven and Came Back. Those are all genuine titles.
How do you write a whole book about that?
Repetitive, going on and on.
Just say the same thing over and over.
The same thing over again, but also endless details. I mean, some of them, honestly, how can anybody... this is what I find so hard. okay, one of these books, the guy goes to heaven and there's a veil between our world and the other world. Okay. And there are gates through this veil. Not just one, lots. They're not pearly, but they are gates. And on the other side, the people who are already dead are waiting for you. And there's a notification system in heaven to tell them when you're coming. So they get to the right gate. Yeah,
it's like they took a number and then
something like that. This is the one that made me feel sick and I just couldn't keep reading it. It was one where a missionary on earth who'd spent her life spreading the good news of Jesus to poor people who didn't know about Jesus gets the best house in heaven. And you know, this is not only like, I don't think missionary is a very good idea, but also giving them the best house. What do you need a house for in heaven? It was a house made of pearls because her name was Pearl, and in a golden street. And all the people in this golden street were raising their arms in praise to God all day.
Yeah, it's impractical, right?
But it's so like, I wouldn't like to go there. Thank you very much. my point is, then I read another one. This little boy goes to heaven, and the gate's quite different. And the angels there don't have wings. Some of them, the angels have wings, and some they don't. It's all just like astral projection theory, which I know more about than is good for anybody, where anything where somebody sees this particular thought form in this way and somebody sees this thought form in a different way, well, this is because the thought creates in the astral, and the astral is a replica, a sort of replica of the physical world, but not exact. I mean, you can explain anything.
You're in the matrix. So, yeah, it's your reality at that point.
No, it's not, because you can meet other people.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's true.
And the thought forms hang around and other people see them. But that conflicts with the idea.
Very confusing to me.
Yeah, but there's always a way to get unconfused if you read enough of the books.
Gotcha.
So the same with the heaven books. You know, don't these people kind of ask questions like, why are the gates so different when different people go there? And why is it only Christians who get St. Peter sitting with the book, whereas the Hindus see the Ramduts and other stuff like that, and Buddhists, you know? I mean, it's not very difficult. You don't have to be very clever, but you do have to be curious.
You have to be curious, and have to think about it.
I don't know how to help people who are not curious to be curious, or would that be cruel? And actually, they're much happier, and I should actually respect their happiness. Instead of what I really want is, let's try to find out the truth about how the world works. And shouldn't everybody enjoy that task? Apparently not.
It's such a bummer. You know, it's true, because it's such a bummer when you meet people who, you know, have obviously never read, like, Sagan and have never kind of experienced the quote-unquote spiritual experience of being connected to our place in the universe. And, ooh, that was a loud pop. Our place in the universe, and thinking about, you know, the breadth and the scope and the beauty, and having these kind of emotional responses to that. They kind of reserve that for their faith. And it's true, you know, quick story. One of the first things that made me really start to question the Mormon faith, the Mormons have like a weird afterlife situation. There's no hell, but there's an outer darkness, and there's three levels of heaven. There's the celestial, the telestial, the terrestrial. So my parents get divorced. My dad gets remarried. They get sealed in the temple. So I'm going to the celestial kingdom with my father and his new wife, who I don't even know, and my mother's in the telestial kingdom. She's not allowed to visit me in the glory of God, but I can go down and, like, see her on the weekends. Like, and it was the weirdest, and it just felt really unfair.
Yeah.
And as a young child, like a 7 or 8 year old, I was like, this is shit. This is not okay. And you start to come to grips with those kinds of things. But you're right. Some people are less entrenched. They don't think about it. It's a little more nebulous, and it's a kind of a positive feeling. And the mean skeptic might be coming to take it away. I think it comes from a fundamental lack within the culture of a really celebrating nature and celebrating science and having this experience where we really are connected to the universe in a grander sense. I know that you you said you're not Zen Buddhist, but you practice Zen.
Yeah.
And I think that is such an important way to connect yourself. It's such a cool approach to maintaining that in your life.
Well, my Zen teacher, who's died now, was really angry with me for saying that, because in his view, whether you're a Buddhist or not a Buddhist, it doesn't really matter. It's neither here nor there. there to specifically say I'm not a Buddhist. It's kind of a non-Buddhist thing to do. I don't know, whatever. But there are a lot of Buddhists who don't believe in the kind of Tibetan idea of personal reincarnation, which is the only reason it's even possible to get involved in this. And I was so pleased that, I mean, on my website, the first thing it says on my Zen page is I'm not a Buddhist, which means I haven't taken the precepts, I haven't made any promises or vows or all of that, so I can't join our local group. I mean, I'm one of the main people in our local meditation group, but I'm not actually allowed to actually join because I haven't done all this, you know, taking the precept stuff. God, I can't remember what I was trying to say now.
That's okay. That's why these podcasts are so fun.
What was I talking about?
How you connect, using kind of Zen to be able to connect.
No. I was really pleased that I have made that point when the Dalai Lama a few years ago made a statement, all Buddhists believe in reincarnation.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
And, you know, I'm not going to sign up to anything that says you have to believe X. I'll sign up to all sorts of things that say, if you want to find this out, you need to do this experiment, or you got your stats wrong, you need to do them better. All kinds of things I'll go along with, but not to say that somebody believes something.
And that's kind of the one thing that keeps a lot of sort of atheists and skeptics out of that culture and out of that movement, is the idea that there are still some sort of dogmatic things that are supernatural. Yeah. And if you can remove that from the equation, I used to go to a yoga class, or actually I had a friend who taught yoga, and she would come to us and we would do atheist yoga. Because there's so many things about it that matter to me and that really were important, but I'm like, don't talk about chakras. Like, you lost me when you started doing that.
Oh, but chakras are really interesting.
Ooh. Okay.
Now, this is something I haven't done, but it's the sort of thing that I might do, and I'm just hoping to have some bright student come along and want to do the stuff. But it seems to me when you start, I have done a little bit of chakra meditation, and it's very powerful. Now, seems to me, given that how much we're now learning about the neuroscience of the construction of self, particularly the body schema is actually inherited. Rare people who are born without all their limbs still have a body schema with the limbs. And it's a very powerful, essential mechanism in the brain. Now, I guess there could be things about the way that's constructed, the way it's connected up to motor cortex, premotor cortex, prefrontal cortex, other essential parts, that would mean that you get particular kind of sense of the straight spine, you know, and that when you imagine light going out of the top of your head, that's a very powerful thing to do. There's got to be some reason why that entails the capacity of the brain to imagine bodies and do things with them. If we could do that, then you'd start to understand why in all these traditions there's a throat chakra and a, you know, whatever. Another thing is, it's associated with this power called Kundalini. Now, you might think this is bonkers. People have a Kundalini experience, and Kundalini rising from the base of the spine. It's a kind of sexual energy. Now, I've done recently some... Why are you laughing? I've done some training recently in something called the jhanas, which are early Buddhist techniques. Actually, they predate Buddhism, I think. I read many, many years ago something about these eight states of consciousness to be reached through concentration. And I thought, well, I could never do that. It sounds amazing, you know, really discrete different states and feeding into the whole altered states of consciousness stuff. And, you know, are there really discrete states? If you could get to them by concentration, amazing. And then I met this guy who teaches it. And I can do some of them. And, you know, you do what he says and you get into this weird altered state. And the first one, you have to fill the body with joy and you have to grin ridiculously and concentrate on the grin. This is his way of doing it. There are other ways of doing it. And you're very, very still. You've done a load of concentration practice before you do this, and then you get this kind of joy, and it's absolutely extraordinary. Through your body comes this heat and this sort of feeling of energy, and you start shaking. And he reckons that it's a self-induced dopamine flood, which then changes down into noradrenaline, and that takes you into the next state. And you have to be really concentrated to get it to happen, but it makes sense. He's done some stuff in fMRI scanners. They haven't yet been able to tell whether the dopamine theory is right, but these are the sort of things that thrill me, that we could find out. It feels very much like descriptions of Kundalini, that we could find out that these stuff that you go, oh, blah, you know, all that woo-woo stuff actually has a physiological basis.
A real change in the brain. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, of course, there will be people who say, oh, yeah, but I didn't mean that stuff. I mean the real thing.
Well, yeah.
But we are getting somewhere, aren't we? And that's the way I like... That's my kind of skepticism, and always has been since... you know, since my parapsychology days, is to take an interest in weird experiences and then say, right, I'm not having any of this, you know, psychic powers and fluences and whatever things they are. Let's find out what's really going on.
It's such a fresh approach for me, I think, and it really does make me open my eyes and think a little bit more about sometimes how quick we can be to just shut things down.
Yes.
And to be
Yes.
so cynical and closed
Yes.
off when it doesn't have to be supernatural to be real.
Yeah.
You know, and we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We should explore what's actually happening.
Yeah.
And maybe listen to these people instead of just, you know, quieting them and saying, it's all bullshit what you're saying.
You were talking earlier about oneness or interconnectedness of everything.
Yeah, just kind of feeling like you're, you know, part of nature. I have a tattoo on my ribs. It's a Sagan quote that says, "We are a way for the cosmos to know itself." You know, one of his famous quotes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love this idea because I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. But I do, you know, I do know that we are made from the same matter that was, you know, created in these supernova. And that this matter can't think. There's no like spirit running through it. It doesn't have conscious capabilities. But as humans and as conscious humans, that's a powerful experience that
yeah,
we have.
Yeah.
We can reflect on ourselves. We can reflect on our place in the universe. As far as we know, we're the only ones. There are likely others, but as far as we know, we're the only ones that we've recorded. And that's meaningful to be able to do that and to just ignore the fact that we have that amazing ability. Really, like, you don't have to be non-feeling to be a materialist.
Yes, which is what a lot of people assume. But I wanted you to say a bit more about that because I think it's one of the things that gets hijacked by people who think they have a monopoly on what they would call a spiritual experience. And that experience of oneness and interconnectedness, and it's a realization that some people have with no scientific whatever, and then they kind of grasp it and say, there you are, that's God, that's, you know. It's actually the height of illogic, because that kind of argument tends to be a dualist argument.
Mm-hmm.
We're all interconnected because we've got telepathy and we've got souls and spirits and we're all connected at the soul level, whereas down here in this murky matter, of course we're not connected. You know, they're kind of missing the whole point. The experience is genuine. So this is one of the things that we can do as spiritual skeptics. Ooh, I've never used that phrase before.
It's kind of scary.
Spiritual skeptics. Of course, the trouble is that I don't mean spirit, but
yeah, it's got baggage a little.
Yeah. But to not allow people to steal that experience, and that's why I picked up on what you were saying, because you were giving me the impression that you were not allowing them to steal it. You're saying because of Sagan and all this stuff, because we know a bit of physics. I mean, if we know a bit of physics, we know that my hands are made of the same stuff, and that, you know, I was born and I'll die, and it's all just stuff happening. We should be able to be awestruck
yes.
by that, allow that to help us to be more empathic, because it is in a way the roots of empathy, because if I know that your body there is made of the same stuff as me, and, you know, I'm more able to accept you as kind of like me,
yeah.
Regardless of your, I mean, you're a white woman, but, you know, if you were a black man or a,
sure.
a you know, or a dog or a duck.
Yeah.
I can be more understanding. So it's important at many levels. That's why I was interested in you bringing that up.
Absolutely. And I think that many people have that experience too, especially those who maybe were raised in a faith and then left. I remember experiencing, I was a singer throughout my life. I studied jazz, vocal jazz, before I went into science. And I used to be the girl at church who would sing a lot. You know, she has a voice. Let's put her up on stage and she'll sing. And she sings at all the funerals and at everything. And I loved sacred music. And when I would hear certain songs, or I would sing certain phrases, I would get goosebumps that moved through me. And of course, that was explained as a religious experience, and that was God moving through me. And then I realized, oh, I just really like music. And you can have these kind of amazing spiritual experiences, because I think music is really a shortcut for so many people to these core emotional experiences that they're not always fully capable at a conscious level of assessing. You know, we see it in, you know, many Oliver Sacks stories. He does talk about it. I don't know if you guys follow follow Oliver Sacks, or you probably did. He talks about, like, in Awakenings, using music to be able to tap into these post-encephalitic individuals, and then they kind of came alive. And we see it a lot with Parkinson's or with Alzheimer's, using music to tap in, and there's this life that comes back into individuals who maybe weren't able to function prior to that. It's so fascinating the way that that can be used to tap into something that we sometimes don't even admit we have, right? Which is deeper consciousness.
I agree with you about the singing. I used to do a lot of singing, and the sacred music, I mean, you know, Bach's chorals, yeah. And, you know, oh, wonderful. But I now play in a samba band.
Oh, cool.
And that's a very interestingly different experience. I think I could sing in a big choir as I used to without ignoring everybody else, really. I'm just singing, got the music there, and, you know, whatever. But in the samba band, it's very much a group thing. And it's wonderfully, especially if you had a smoke first, it's wonderfully sort of trance-inducing. Every Thursday night, I mean, a little village I live in has the most fabulous 13th century church. Wonderful place.
God, and we don't have that shit in America.
We practice every Thursday night in there, and just really get into, and you have to listen to the whole band, and you have to, and you just get kind of carried away in it. I should tell you this. I went into the church the first rehearsal, and we started to make it. Samba's really, really loud. I mean, we're bashing away on these drums. There's probably 20, 25 of us all making a huge noise. And I kind of felt a bit sacrilegious because I brought up as a Christian, yeah. And, you know, and I thought, ooh, it's just a little bit, until I saw written over the where the bells from in the bell tower are, and big wooden thing, and it said, "Praise him with the loud cymbals."
Yay! That's so good. I love that.
So now I'm happy. It's a lovely place to
go. Oh, that's wonderful.
A lot of our churches are being turned over to other uses. This one is still primarily a church, but I think it's really nice when it in such a fabulous space that was, after all, was built by all the people and lived in the village then, as a communal space, and now it's kind of
being used that way again.
A little bit. We need more of that, because, yeah, they built it for God, but that was because the time they lived and the beliefs they had. Primarily, they were building it to be used.
Of course. You know, we're obviously running really low on time, which is a bummer with podcasts, because I always want to go longer than I should. This has been such an incredible chat, and I feel like I've learned so much more about your experience and from you. There's obviously so many more things to cover, but I would love, before we end it, to close with the same two questions that I ask everyone that I have on the show.
Okay.
Some of you already know what they are. They are, I'm kind of a dick because they're like really big picture annoying questions. But I want you to answer them in whatever way matters to you. It can be a personal answer. It can be a more global answer. And the first one is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that really concerns you, keeps you up most at night, worries you? On the flip side of that, so we can actually end on a high note, what are you most optimistic and excited and hopeful for?
Global warming, no question. Mm-hmm. I live in Devon. My house is right on a little river, and we got catastrophically flooded a few years ago. And these floods are getting more and more. I'm watching. One of my favorites on the top of my, you know, computer is a site that regularly updates all the temperature charts and sea level charts and everything. And I'm watching those. And I think I'm a bit weird. We moved down there to this place, and I grow loads of veg, and we have chickens and what have you, with this kind of faint idea that, you know, it's all going to go terribly wrong, society's going to collapse in a few years, and, you know, we need to be self-sufficient. And two things that kind of dawned on me rather slowly, because I'm a bit thick that way, is one, if it really does happen, we're going to be dead, because the people, and we don't have many people with guns in England.
Oh, yeah.
But there are enough that they would probably come and just shoot you and take your food and, you know, whatever, or come and strangle you or something or other. I mean, it would be very, very hard. Secondly, it's really hard, even in Britain, where, I mean, in Devon, we have a nice climate at the moment, to grow enough food to feed yourself. It's just really impractical.
And it's hard to make it through the winter if you don't have energy. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. And, yeah, we've got lots of trees to cut down to use for fuel, but then, you know, sawing is going to take... You don't have enough hours in the day to do it. And secondly, it's going more slowly than I thought. And that's a bad thing in a way. I sort of want awful things to happen that don't do too much harm to people, but awful things that will wake up the world
Well, we just need to see more awful things happening in the first world. I think that's...
Yes. Like to say your country and...
Yeah, no. It's true. Because awful things are happening, but they're happening far away in places where we're not thinking about those. And it's a terrible... Of course, the least, able among us are going to be the first that are the hardest hit. Those with the most poverty and those with the least ability to be able to fight back.
Well, not necessarily. Mainly, yes, but there will be some people who still have the skills
That's true. And we don't. We are just totally dependent.
I mean, yeah, exactly. An awful lot of modern city-dwelling people would not have the first clue. And I'd be terrified of the dark.
Yeah.
How many people nowadays have seen real dark? You know, I mean, where I live...
First time I saw the Milky Way, I lost my mind.
Yeah.
Like, it was insane.
Yeah. I mean, even where I live, because there's a little town about 2 miles away, there's enough light in the sky that I can just about, if I dark adapt, get around the garden. And if that wasn't there, there would be moonless nights when it would be completely pitch black. And, that's a trivial thing in a way. But there may be some... If enough first world people die, there may be some third world people, or certainly people in the Arctic, for example, who can carry on with their fishing livelihoods and so on. If they still have those skills, they might survive when the rest of us clever clogs are all gone.
So true.
I don't know. Your second half, going on with the climate change thing, I tried many years ago now, I decided I was going to give up flying. I mean, I thought it was that serious, and this was about 8-9 years ago. I'm going to give up flying. I'm never going to fly again. And I was in the States, and I thought, this is the last time I'm ever going to go there, because you can't get there anymore by ships. And then a few months later, I was invited to speak at TED. And I said, nope, I'm not going, I don't fly. And then they asked me again. And then Dan Dennett, a philosopher who's involved very much in TED, rang me up and he said, Sue, you have got to go to TED. You can't say no. And I'm going, why not? And, now it seems obvious because TED lectures are so famous. But it wasn't obvious then back in 2008. Anyway, I went. From then on, I decided I would do one return flight a year. And I did that for 5 years, turning down so many invitations to go to amazing places and give lectures. And at the end of that 5 years, which is now, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, I just thought, I can't do this anymore. It's stupid. I'd sort of felt, if we scientists who understand the problem are not prepared to really give up something in our lives, nothing's going to change, so I must do it. But after 5 years of doing it, and very other few people are doing it, and the world's carrying, there's more air conditioning and more heating and more light and more, everything is carrying more cars and, And so I thought, I've only got one life, and so I went back to, selfishly, I'm going on planes.
It's hard,
It's hard.
I drive electric, which I think does help, and it's easy to do in L.A. If I lived in Texas, I don't think I could drive electric, but you can't not fly. I mean, there's certain things that just, we have to see systemic changes at the cultural level. It's individuals, we should do everything we can at the individual level, but we won't be able to move that, kind of go over that hurdle unless we see better regulation, unless we see more...
I mean, it has to come from the top.
Yeah.
I will be willing to drop my standard of living, which is pretty high. I live in the world we all live here, which is pretty great. I would be willing to drop it quite a lot if everybody else did too.
Yeah, right.
and that can only happen by legal, by governments taking hold of it.
What are you excited for?
I was just going to say,
we want a positive note.
I realized yesterday in a really fantastic talk we had about the future that there's so many things that I don't know about, and that I tend to be, and this is a bad admission, but because I can't imagine the technology in even 5 years' time, I believe we're all going to be dead by then anyway, because I can't imagine it. And that's pathetic. So my answer is, I don't know, and I really need to be more optimistic about the future and more interested in the possibilities, more imaginative about all these things coming along. And, I'll try. You inspired me to have another go at being a bit more optimistic about the future.
I love that. What's such a great answer to close on. So Susan, let everybody know who's listening. Are you active on social media? Where can they find all of your work? How can they find you when they're surfing Tate and
interwebs?
I am not at all active. Okay. No. My assistant does a Facebook page for me. Actually, I write little stuff and put it on. I'll put something about you on there probably.
Nice.
But that's the limit of my engagement. On my website, if it goes there and it's contacts, it says basically fuck off.
but they can see all of your work on your website.
I've got a massive website. Mm-hmm. That's what I enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. And that's not social media, is it? It's antisocial. It's just me and my website. But I keep that up to date. That's what I do. And there's massive. All my publications are on there, and loads of videos and other stuff is all there, and then you can find it. But I'm afraid to say I became so swamped with email that I just have to be brutal.
You have to.
Because
you need privacy.
I'm so bad at not replying. You know, if someone sends me a heart-rending story, I want to reply. He says, just please don't send
it. Just don't send it. Yeah, it's much easier.
I can't cope with them all. So I manage by being, I'm sorry, a little bit isolated. And my main thing in life is I sit at home with my, you know, big garden and chickens and what have you and the river, and write books is what I really want to do. And you can't do that if you're spending your time tweeting and doing all these
other things. It becomes a full-time job. Well, guys, if you want to tweet about the conversation, just use the hashtag Sue Blackmore. You don't have to tweet at her. We'll turn her into a hashtag.
You do that.
Yeah, Susan, thank you so much for joining me. This was so much fun. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.
Thank you.